CJSF is looking for new volunteers to come in and make radio. No experience is necessary. You can learn to DJ, edit sound, produce news, make posters, and host your own show. Come out to a weekly station orientation to get involved. Orientation times can be found on our website at www.cjsf.ca.
Canadian Philosophy Show. I am your host, Brandon, and I am joined today with my co-hosts, Aaron Wang and Hale Rothery. Today, I'm going to be introducing someone who's not usually considered a media theorist, but who I think has a distinction that might be helpful in discussing something that media theorists will be talking about, or continuing our episode basically on AI. And ChatGPT, but I'm also interested in not just ChatGPT, but also things like text-to-image generation, which is, it's kind of in that same vein of discourse about AI. I think that obviously they're like two different things, but when people discuss these things, they come quite close. But I'm talking about Hannah Arendt, her distinction between, or a distinction she draws within the activity of action, or of, well, the activity, action is one of those activities, but she draws this distinction out in a work that she put out in the 60s called The Human Condition. And again, The Human Condition is not ostensibly about media theory, but again, I think it has a salient distinction that can be introduced into the media theory discourse about things like AI and ChatGPT and whatnot. In this work, Hannah Arendt, she is analyzing activity, specifically the life of activity, the vita activa. Later on, she would discuss the other side of the human condition, the vita contemplativa, in the life of the mind. That's a whole other book. We may have a chance to get to that at some point, but for now we're discussing her analysis of activity. And she draws a distinction, a three-way distinction between labor, work, and action. Now, action is the one that most Arendt scholars are interested in because it's kind of the most optimistic in a way. It's where freedom and the plurality of mankind exist. But for this discussion, I'm more interested in the two more productive forms because I'm interested in exploring AI as a mode of production. We've talked about Walter Benjamin's piece, The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction. Mechanical reproduction is not really what AI seems to be. For Benjamin, mechanical reproduction has this tendency to reproduce the same thing infinitely, his case in point being the camera. But if you think about something like ChatGPT or, you know, say Stable Diffusion, they don't produce the same thing even if you include the same prompts. A neural network seems to generate something fresh each time. So the framework of mechanical reproduction, even though we're working with machines, does not seem to suit what is discussed when we talk about AI exactly. The reason I bring up the distinction between labor and work, though, is because what I'm interested in is the kind of activity that one is doing when one uses these AI models or these AI systems. Whether ChatGPT or something like Stable Diffusion, text-to-image generation. And I think that the distinction between these two can kind of illuminate a lot of what people are trying to get at, but often conflate when they talk about, well, what is it doing? What is it mean for us? And I think it the distinction kind of can shed some light. So the distinction between labor and work for Arendt involves, well, they're both activities. They are activities that aim to do something. The activity of labor, specifically its task, is the sustaining of life. It is concerned with life. So, for example, people produce food, people produce clothes, people reproduce. It is all in the service of sustaining life. Now, the thing about this is it has a distinct structure from work, which we'll get to, but because it's always in service of life, there's a kind of cyclical endlessness to labor. When you labor, you are always working and consuming the product that labor produces. So it comes with a certain sense of futility that work doesn't have. And by contrast, work has a mean to end relationship. And not only that, the product of work survives the activity. So, I mean, when you labor, in a way, the product doesn't actually survive. Well, it does survive the activity, but it's consumed almost just as quickly. You know, you make breakfast and then you eat it 20 minutes later. Whereas work produces something that is intended to survive for longer. Arendt says that the aim of work is not life. Well, it contributes to life too, but it's worldliness. It's how we produce a world into which we belong. We introduce stability into the world by creating products that exist around us. We can alter our environment like that. Action is a little, it's not what I'm interested in right now, but I think it has something to do with the last time we talked about AI, which was specifically the question of democratic inputs. So I'll just touch on it very lightly. Basically, for Arendt, action is activity undertaken to individuate someone. So humans are not just human. They are particular embodied people. You can intelligibly ask the question, who are you? And action is meant to answer that question. Who are you? You show that through your words and deeds. That is essentially what action is. It's much more interesting than that. She has a lot to say about freedom and this interesting notion of plurality and natality, that action is possible because we are born, and that action is always unpredictable, and it's crazy. But let's go back to labor and work. Labor and work have different standards and different objects.
I was a little curious, and I'm glad you clarified how Arendt drew a distinction between labor and work, because those are two things that in casual conversation are kind of more or less equivalent. So it's really good there that you drew that distinction, that labor is creating something that doesn't seem to have permanence, and work creates something that seems to have a greater degree of permanence. So building a technology or a building or something that has a use after that labor, and that use is somewhat continuous in time. Mm-hmm. It is perhaps not a distinction that is like super, super clear cut, because tools break, computers break, buildings break down, so nothing really has permanence. So it's kind of like more like a continuum or a spectrum, where you have like things that are more like labor and things that are more like work.
Yeah, I think permanence captures what Arendt is going for, but she specifically uses the word durability, I think, to capture what you're trying to allude to. Things do break down, and the distinction isn't super clear cut. I mean, what distinction really is? But because in a way, work also alters labor, which is what I'll get into now. Did you want to say something?
Yeah, I was just going to jump in and say, before you go into it, you'll probably touch on it a little bit, but I was also going to say, I really like how you broke down that distinction. And it's like not to me, again, I kind of agree with Aaron. It's not super clear cut, but at the same time, when the phrase worldliness came up in relation to work, that kind of rang a bell for me, especially with my background and some of the other existentialists and phenomenologists. And what I immediately thought was, you know, I get how work has something to do with like a project. Like labor obviously has this sort of like necessary undertaking for the maintenance of life. And I like how you described it as almost like futile or cyclical. It's this like ongoing process, right? Like once you start it, think about the simplest one, like you said, farmer farming food, right? Or what would be another one? Like maintaining one's dwelling, right? Against the elements, like these super, super basic things. It's a constant, but especially in like our more modern, what's the word I'm looking for? Not just diversified society, they're not like personally defining. And that's obviously where activity comes in. But when I hear the phrase work, like I think about how you could have the same sort of project and two different individuals could come at it from both a labor and a work perspective. And so what I was immediately thinking about was right beside my own personal work, a building is being torn down. And today I walked by and there were people, there were like laborers on the building doing like menial tasks, which to me read out as being like, I'm here for personal sustenance. That's like my primary reason of being here. But like on the street were very people who were very clearly not laborers, although they were in hard hats, who were very clearly engineers. And it just made me think about that because the way they were like disposed to this project was one that was, I guess you could, the best word is that it's like their project, right? Like, yeah, sure, they are an engineer. Like that's their job. It's their vocation. But there's also something different going on there in terms of having a sort of defining purpose or goal in terms of what they're actually doing and trying to produce that's more meaningful to them and their experience than just like getting a paycheck to survive. Obviously, like in the real world, that's kind of built in.
It's a good example for showing how Arendt actually says modernity, one of the symptoms of modernity is the running together of these two things. And in fact, it's not just a running together, but a victory of labor over work. What used to resemble introducing durability into the world and sustaining the world and its worldliness actually becomes a task for labor as people take up what we call jobs and get paid and sustain themselves on what is ostensibly work. Labor begins to take over the task of work. The criteria of labor becomes applied to work. And she says that one of the products or one of the results of this is something like a world alienation. And not only a world alienation, but a kind of transformation of the way that the world is understood. One of the examples being the idea of, I mean, think about how, if you really think about it, it's quite ridiculous to think of something like shoes or shirts to be consumables. They have a certain durability, but under the view of the victory of labor, these are seen as something to be produced and to decay. Nothing really survives being created in modernity. Everything is a product which is used and to sustain our lives. The kind of thinking of if this, then that, that is inherent to work where a person sits down to craft something in a certain way is not applicable to something like fast fashion. It doesn't really matter the way it's made. It only matters insofar as it sustains the life process. And in that way, everything kind of, not everything, but much of what was previously labor or work, sorry, has become labor in that sense because the activities of producing it were done under the circumstances of sustaining life.
The way you were describing that, the sort of intrusion of and the conflation of both labor and work really reminded me, or I want to say even more, like the intrusion of work into modern productive society, really reminded me actually a little bit. I've been reading quite a bit recently about Soviet Union, especially the first several decades, and the sort of socialist utopia model and the sort of philosophy and thinking around it, which was obsessed with labor, but not in the way that, like, it's kind of ironic, right? Because Marx wrote a lot about how, like, one, you know, in capitalism, people are getting alienated from their work, from the labor, which I, you know, I think is a true statement in many cases. But at the same time, there's a way in which, like, socialists, the socialist utopia's obsession with universal labor also was very alienating, because it really divorced people from work, right? Like, again, coming back to this idea of, like, what's important is the project, what's important is actually created. And it's like, it reverses that. And it's like, no, what's important is having people work and producing stuff. And whether it's tractors or shoes or tanks or paintings or posters or whatever, the important thing is that stuff is coming off the assembly line and that everyone is involved in doing that. You know, what ends up happening with those things at the end of the day is less important. Like, what those things actually are, what we do with them, all that kind of stuff. What's more important is the actual, like, labor process itself that is more essential. And I think that, like, it's a weird way in which, like, I think in a slightly different way, you see that in, like, the modern neoliberal capitalist society, whatever you want to call it. But I think it's a really, like, clear cut in the kind of very socialist utopia model that you especially saw in the first few decades of the Soviet Union, when they were really obsessed with the concept of labor being, like, universal labor being central to the whole system.
If we're thinking about work, this is kind of the argument for capitalism. These people who are the capitalists, who really want to accumulate, essentially, by Arendt's definition, work. They want to accumulate enduring assets, durable assets. And because they want to create these assets, they employ people to create these assets, and society benefits from the creation of these assets, also known as capital. Adam Smith's perspective is that we should allow capitalists to exist for the overall benefit of society, as long as they play by the rules, and they need to play by fair rules under the rule of law. That's obviously, like, there's problems with that, but I think it really speaks to kind of the heart of when Arendt was writing in, you know, the 20th century, where there was a big conflict around these types of ideas. There's an element of truth in both, I think, of those philosophies. When you start talking about individual systems, there's a lot of complexity, and if you make the point of society to let individuals run away, accumulate capital and force people to do work in unhealthy conditions, well, that doesn't seem like a good society. On the other side of things, just as Hale was saying about socialist utopias, if you make labor the end goal and everyone gets to do labor, but the end result of their work isn't necessarily something that really benefits them, that also doesn't seem to be a great society to live in. So I think Arendt has some very applicable philosophy that came out of the 20th century.
In The Human Condition, Arendt does explicitly say, like, man, Marx got stuff real right. She wishes that there wasn't this kind of taboo around it, but his analysis of labor and whatnot was quite influential. Obviously it was, but also insightful. The one thing that Arendt does criticize Marx for is the equation of labor with humanity, that humans are the anima laborans, that we are meant to work, or to labor, I should say. It has an interesting consequence when you come to the communist project of abolishing labor with the realization of automation, because that would essentially be to abolish the point of being human. So, and it's easy to, we can imagine humans existing in a fully automated world, so that can't be completely true, even though that would be quite a sci-fi future. The other thing I want to respond to as well is in your discussion or in your thoughts of the capitalists as people accumulating work. I think that is essentially right, but what I think should be said is that the capitalist, in order to accrue works, must have workers to produce them. Now, it's one thing to say that a worker produces something. It's another thing to say that a laborer produces something. And the conditions for the difference are, is this person producing something in order to contribute to the world? Or is this person merely doing something in order to sustain themselves? And if this is incorrect, you can tell me, maybe there was a period where people were just like naturally producing things and then the capitalist was an accumulator of that. But for the most part, the capitalist accumulates through laborers because they pay them, and then those people use that wage to sustain their capacity to sell their labor. So I think for the most part,
so just to use a historical example,
For sure.
Because I took a world history course, and
okay,
I use it at every single opportunity I get. This is a really obscure historical example, and hopefully at some point in the future, a historian or someone professional can research this a little bit better. But essentially, the Inca in South America had a very interesting system, which is that they would... Because essentially they were the administrators of a rather large territory, and I don't exactly know how they got that territory because I don't remember everything from my history class. But how they would administer that territory was they essentially had storehouses in each of these villages. And what they would do is they would take the crops that were produced by the workers, and they would put all of that stuff in the storehouses. And then they would, you know, sometimes shuffle resources between storehouses. But if there was ever a famine, they would open the storehouses to the people so that it would benefit them. So that's like, I mean, I'm not sure what the Inca's money system was. There's a lot we don't know in history, but it's always struck me as a really interesting example of kind of like what you would imagine an ideal system being, like a system that benefits the workers by its existence. Like they pay into it. It's essentially like why we still think life insurance is a good idea. But like it's something that you pay into for security so that if you end up needing it, you have it. And then if you end up not needing it, well, you've, you know, taken care of that risk.
Interesting. That does sound really, that sounds like a very intuitive, intuitively appealing sort of, food safety net. That's interesting.
And just on the point of kind of interesting historical notes, you sort of asked a little bit earlier, Brandon, about sort of hinted at the possibility of pre-capitalist relations. Well, I'm certainly no history of capitalism. I will say that at least from my knowledge, when I went on a little like early pre-recorded history kick a while back, that it seems that like the, you know, capitalism in its modern forms, I feel like we're so far off the modern topic, but that's okay. Is something that really arose with the trader class. And that wasn't so much a thing in very early Eurasian societies. So we're talking like 10,000 BC. And it's, at least from the kind of stuff that I researched, it seems that most archaeologists agree that a lot of these very early, what we would describe as civilizations that weren't nomadic, the first stationary, first farmer civilizations, were pretty egalitarian. But as you started to have communication and trade between different communities throughout, especially throughout Mesopotamia, that's where you started to get this sort of the sort of trader class, which we can think about as like the earliest point. And it's also interesting how we think about, when we think about those who don't do labor but do work, we also think about people who aren't situated in one particular zone or community in the same way as like the classic laborer farmer ideal. And also too, are individuals which are, I think, and this is probably more important, are individuals that are specialized. So in these really egalitarian labor-focused societies, specialization doesn't seem to be as much of a thing, right? Like everybody knew how to farm. Everybody kind of knew how to do pottery. Everybody kind of knew how to do ritualistic things. You might have had like kind of a shamanistic person. It's really hard, as Aaron into that, it's very hard to understand and know, but that seems to be the case. But then you introduce this kind of specialized trader class, which is focused on a kind of work, a kind of project that is effectively resource accumulation without the process of labor in the traditional sense that we're thinking about within these societies.
I do want to push back on that a little bit, mainly because in my history test book, it does kind of state like basically exactly what Hale said, that we had this essentially hunter-gatherer societies that were egalitarian. And then we have the what they call the agrarian revolution, where farming is adopted in Mesopotamia, and that leads to an explosion in population. And that's kind of where we see the first hierarchical class structures, because now there's enough food that not everyone has to always be scrounging around for food. However, this has been disputed by some anthropologists. So some anthropologists dispute that, basically because essentially, the argument here is an argument from silence. Like, we don't really know a lot about hunter-gatherer societies. They might be more egalitarian than we are, or that future societies were, but that doesn't really tell us what they were exactly. Like, it might be the case that there were some people who were much better at pottery than they were at farming, so they did more pottery, and they kind of specialized in that to some degree, not to the level that we do today, but they did specialize somewhat. It is also possible that, like, there were still inventors, right? Like, someone had to invent the first spear, someone had to invent the first fireplace, so someone had to invent like the first type of housing that people use and stuff like that. So there are some concepts of ownership, some concepts of trades, and concepts of individuation, I think, even at the very basic level of human history. But I do think that in terms of development, what Hale said is entirely 100% correct, that there was not organized trade in the world, and then there was organized trade in the world. And in early Mesopotamia, we see like the first development of language, mainly in terms of counting crops and symbols and tokens for different crops and for different groups of people. So, and then they use these symbols. So writing kind of emerges because of the necessity for trade.
I'm glad we have two historians on deck. It's fun. We're not actually going all that far afield. This is it's all a discussion of the relation between labor and work.
Yeah, but now I'm really interested to hear what's going on in the 21st and maybe even the 22nd century with labor and work.
Yeah, we'll see. I just want to remind our listeners that you are listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and I have been joined by Aaron and Hale. We are in the middle of our media theory series, and we are discussing AI in the frame of Hannah Arendt's distinction between labor and work and potentially action. So let's get into actually applying this framework to AI. So my interest in trying to apply this kind of framework is actually sitting down, doing whatever it is that you do when you use an AI system, and asking, okay, what are we doing here? So let's try to actually think about what we're doing when we actually use these AI systems in terms of Hannah Arendt's distinction between labor and work. Now, the interesting thing is people have already kind of been doing that. And by when I say people, I mean, you know, the nebulous discursive entity that is the internet. People have been worried about things like ChatGPT replacing people's jobs, you know, writers worrying about their work. With text-to-image generators, artists have been concerned as well. But if we think about what it is that the AI systems are doing when people are